Hey, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning, but we're going to start the Monday morning movie reviews a little bit later on. After the 3 o'clock news, we'll be joined by Colin Suter and Jim Laskowski, who's filling in for Eric Childress. But this week's new movie reviews and the movie reviews for Monday will start at 3. Because we want to take this moment to welcome to the show Eric Childress, who is at the South by Southwest Film Festival right now, live. And we're going to get a preview of some of the movies that he's seen and all kinds of cool stuff. So we wanted to check in with Eric first, and then we'll have Colin and Jim in after 3 to review all the new movies. But let's bring Eric Childress in, and here is Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hey, man.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing just great.
Good. Now, we need to talk, obviously. How many movies have you seen? How long have you been in Austin?
I've been here since Friday afternoon, and I've seen a dozen movies since then.
Jeez. All right, 12 movies in 2.5 days, so there you go.
Yeah.
We got to start off with what you did last night.
Mm-hmm.
You happen to be kind of a fan of Steven Spielberg.
A little bit. If you followed the show a little bit, I think you might get that impression.
Yeah, yeah. You like Steven Spielberg in the same way that I like John Carpenter.
Maybe even more.
Yeah. Well,
if that's possible.
He's obviously got this new movie coming out, which looks crazy. It's called Ready Player One, and it comes out at the end of the month.
Yeah.
And they had the big premiere at South by Southwest last night, and you were there.
I was there. I was there in the second row. This was not a film that was announced as part of the regular schedule. There was a TBA that was kind of hanging loose on the schedule when it was announced. And when they finally sort of announced what the running time was going to be, people started to sort of clue into what it could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was officially announced on Saturday that it was, in fact, going to be Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously then how did you get tickets?
Well, I got in touch with a really lovely woman from Warner Brothers who was aware of my Spielberg love.
Yeah.
I suppose. And and went out of her way to make sure I got a ticket to get into it. I was actually in line for the movie. I was actually in line for the movie like 3 hours early.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure I got in, and I got an email from her while I was in line saying, hey, I got a ticket for you, and I went out in front, and she had a ticket for me, so I was able to get in early, and so I was in the second row of the theater to see this movie, and lo and behold, Steven Spielberg was here.
Now, were there cast members there, too?
Yeah, Ty Sheridan was here, Lena Waithe was here, a couple of the other cast members, Olivia Cooke was here, and some other people who were formed sort of the hero team. Ben Mendelsohn was here. So they had a real eclectic group on stage. And then on top of it, Steven Spielberg, who I'm sitting literally a row and a height of a stage from for the first time in my life.
Wow, that's awesome, man. Did you say Olivia Cooke was there?
Yes.
Oh, man.
I know you got some positive things to say about that coming up.
Oh, man. Yeah. Eric.
Yeah. I know you like the Thoroughbreds.
Oh, man.
It's a good film.
That's an understatement, man. Oh, yeah. My God. All right. Well, Steven Spielberg's there. Everybody's there. And he introduced the movie. What was it like at the beginning?
It was kind of crazy. I mean, it's like even Janet Pearson, who, you know, is in charge of the festival, she kind of even stumbled over her words. Just the mere opportunity to introduce Steven Spielberg, who is not, you know, particularly known for, you know, having films at film festivals. He's at a couple in New York and, you know, some international festivals, Cannes, obviously, but not, you know, a lot of local festivals. And he certainly never had anything at South by Southwest.
No, I know.
Before.
It's pretty unprecedented, you know?
It really is. And for him to be here in attendance, too, was such a major deal. So she even stumbled over her words, like, just like, ladies and gentlemen, Steven Spielberg. And he came out. And, of course, I couldn't resist standing up.
Well, yeah.
And I recorded the entire thing. It was kind of crazy. For me, it was the equivalent of the Beatles and Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the closest comparison I can absolutely make.
Cool.
And it was an absolute, an absolute bucket list moment for me.
Very, very cool. Okay, now, I understand, though, because I got a little text from you that they actually had a little problem with the film.
Yeah.
And I can't actually read what you wrote. on the air because there was an expletive in it.
Yeah, there was.
But the film froze at one point?
At one point, the film did have a technical glitch at the theater, which is not the first time there have been technical glitches at the
Yeah, but it's the first time that there's been a technical glitch while Steven Spielberg is there.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And and this was the first audience that the film has been shown to at all.
Wow.
So it's literally the first screening of the film anywhere. So add that on top of it. So, yeah, so I sent you this text in the middle of them trying to correct this flaw. And the thing is, that it actually kind of worked out in their favor. And I'll tell you why. Because at first, the glitch happened right during literally the crossover moment into the climactic action sequence of the film.
Oh, boy.
And it's a moment in the film, I think there might be a little bit of it in the trailer, but it's literally a moment where, like, everything you could possibly imagine is just like just shows up on the battlefield, okay?
Yeah.
And so the sound went out.
Mm-hmm.
So for a moment, everyone thought it was kind of like that great moment in Last Jedi with Laura Dern.
Right,
so
right.
It seemed like it was going to be that moment, but then it just like the sound wasn't coming back, and we were like, oh no,
yeah,
you know. But so they stopped the film, and then they're just like, we don't know what's going on. We're trying to fix it. And then they rewound the film, tried to do it again. It happened again, and we're like, oh, no. And we were sitting there going, like, are they going to fix this? And then they did it again, and then they get to that moment, and it worked.
Mm.
And it happened to be at the moment where literally everyone in the possible, you know, cinematic universe is charging, making their heroic charge. So literally the entire audience just filled in the gaps.
Hmm.
And we're just with it, and all of a sudden just started shouting at the screen, and we're with it for the rest of the film.
All right, well, tell everybody about Ready Player One, then.
Yeah, well, this is based on a book by Ernest Cline, who is a local here in Austin, so it kind of makes sense that they would, you know, have this premiere here. And, it's a story about set in the future, it's 2045, and it's kind of a, you know, not really post-apocalyptic, but, you know, things have not gone well for Earth.
Mm-hmm.
People live in slums and stuff, and maybe it's basically everyone to get away from their lives sort of live in their own sort of matrix. They live in what was called the Oasis, which is basically this virtual reality world where everyone has their own avatar and they're able to, you know, to play games and, you know, live out their fantasies, whatever they might be interested in. And that's what everybody does to sort of get away from it. And so there's sort of a Willy Wonka-like story to the film where one of the designers of the Oasis was played by Mark Rylance. After he died, he had put in this contest where people have to find these keys, go through these car races and find the clues to uncover these keys that are going to lead someone to eventually take sole ownership of the Oasis. And, you know, basically, you know, when you're in the Oasis and you're doing these video games or whatever, you collect coins the way you would like Mario Brothers or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And that's your currency. So if you die, you lose all your money, basically. And that's how they kind of keep people down. And when they get to the point where, you know, people are able to participate in this contest and no one's been successful at it for years, they're able to offer the opportunity to basically take over the entire Oasis and be like one of the richest people on the planet.
Mm.
Yeah, and the Ty Sheridan plays the hero of the movie. Olivia Cooke plays another gamer who is kind of part of a revolution. Ben Mendelsohn plays, of course, the evil head of the corporation that is hired all of these, you know, potential gamers to try to hack the system and try to get and find these keys themselves so they can control the Oasis. So it's, you know, this typical, you know, 80s kind of, you know, corporate greed battle going on. When you've seen, you describe the movie as a crazy movie. When you see the previews of the movie, you clearly see that there are a lot of pop culture references.
Yeah.
Characters that show up from other movies, and, you know, it's almost like a kind of like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit for the gamer world, basically.
Hmm.
And, you know, what Spielberg is, you know, I mean, a lot of these references, I suppose, was in the book. I didn't ever finish the book, but a lot of the stuff was in the book. And, you know, Spielberg incorporates that so wonderfully in the movie, to the point that even the visual effects designers, as he said during the Q&A, were even slapping in stuff from his own movies that he wasn't even aware of. Just throwing in references like Gremlins and the T-Rex and things like that. You know, I don't want to give away too many spoilers.
Because
that's really one of the pleasures of the film. And Spielberg had a great quote during the Q&A where he said that, like, if you're, you know, you've watched through, you know, basically the windshield, you're watching the story. If you kind of veer off through the side windows, you catch all of the pop culture references that are going on. But the story is still, you know, enticing enough to, you know, to get you through. It's not just a pure nostalgia trip at all.
Right, right. And so overall, you liked it?
I'm very happy. I think it's an incredibly entertaining movie. And, you know, I mean, again, we're talking about Spielberg, so to put it, you know, in the context of his entire career, it's going to come in on the lower spectrum of that. But that being said, I think that this is a movie that is going to be the kind of, the way that, you know, that Jurassic World, in a way, sort of brought back a new generation for Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a film that is going to bring a new generation around to what the, you know, some of the magical creations that Spielberg has created over the years. I think it has that absolute sensibility that he, you know, excels at. It's an incredibly manic film. I mean, this thing is going to be insane in IMAX. I assume that they're showing this in IMAX.
Yeah.
It's gonna be an insane experience there. But it plays very much like, I compare it to like the Lego movies. That there are a lot of pop culture references being thrown at you. There's a lot of manic energy going on in the movie. It spends, and in many ways, it's almost like an animated film.
Yeah.
It spends a lot of time in the Oasis, and it's a lot of avatars and animation and special effects. And you know, sometimes I wish that they had spent a little more time in the real world, because the set decoration of the real world is really quite striking. The stacks of these slum cities and things is really quite something to look at.
Right.
But I had a really fun time.
Okay.
Movie, right. And I think a lot of people will too.
All right. Now, you went to the party afterwards?
I did.
All right, hang on a second.
I did.
Okay, hold on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to hear about that. He was at the big party afterwards. He saw Ready Player One. Spielberg was 10 feet away from him, so he's happy right now. But we got a break here for the news, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Eric and get more reviews from the South by Southwest Film Festival. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in later and tell a jokey time. And, of course, we will do the Monday morning movie reviews. Jim Leskowski is filling in for Eric this week, and Colin will be here. We're doing it after the 3 o'clock news, starting it a little bit late because we're getting exclusive reports from Austin, Texas, at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Eric Childress is there. He's seen a dozen movies since he got there on Friday, and he was at the big premiere for Ready Player One. Spielberg was there, and we were just talking about that. And let's get back to it. And here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hey, man.
All right. So the post movie party, where was it?
It was at one of the local, places on the route here, basically. It was like almost like a little warehouse kind of area, which is, there's a lot of here in Austin. So it was just a little kind of out-of-the-way area. Not so much out of the way. It was right on the way to our hotel, actually, which was kind of nice.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it wasn't like an overcrowded kind of thing. There were still a lot of people seeing movies and things. But the thing that really stood out about the party, Spielberg, to my knowledge, didn't seem to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Ty Sheridan. I saw at least another member of the cast there. But the performance, the entertainment for the party was Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
Come on!
Yeah.
No, come on now!
Yeah, no.
Oh!
I watched Joan Jett and the Blackhearts do an hour set.
That's unbelievable. So the house band at this party was Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
That's right.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. We talk about the pop culture references in the film, and that includes the music cues as well. The fact that you would have, you know, an 80s icon like Joan Jett there makes complete sense.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, as people gathered and they had, if you've seen some of the poster art for the movie, they've basically taken the characters from the movie and put them into like 80s posters.
Yes, I've seen that. I saw the Risky Business one, which was
yes, that was there. They've done that to Labyrinth and Breakfast Club and Back to the Future, obviously. Literally, this is sort of a film geek orgy of film references, and that alone is entertaining enough. But I think that, you know, the signature Spielberg touches that he brings to the movie make it all the more entertaining.
Wow, great. So that's a great night, man. That is a great night.
It's pretty terrific.
Yeah, seeing your favorite director up close, sitting in on the Q&A, seeing the premiere of the movie, and then Joan Jett and the Black Hearts.
Yeah, that's a good night.
Yes, it is, man. That's good. Good for you, man. Good for you.
Thank you.
All right. So let's get to it. Let's talk about some of the other movies that you've seen. Where do you want to start? Where do you want to start?
Well, we might as well go back to opening night.
Okay.
The opening night film at the festival this year was A Quiet Place.
Oh, Krasinski.
Which is John Krasinski's sci-fi horror film, which when you say that, it rolls off the tongue very oddly.
Yeah.
Because Krasinski has directed a couple of movies. Nothing of which would compare to what A Quiet Place is, thematically or in, tone or genre.
I got to say, the trailer for this movie is fantastic.
Yeah, and I made a point to not watch the trailer.
Okay.
I had heard of the movie. I saw a couple snippets and some TV ads and things like that, but I didn't know a whole lot about the movie going in, other than the people in the movie have to be quiet. What the premise of the movie is, without giving away too much, is that some sort of alien apocalypse has happened, and the few survivors that are left, which basically consist of John Krasinski's family. It's him, he's the father, Emily Blunt is the mother, and they have some children. And there, as the movie opens, the apocalypse has happened, and seemingly everyone has been wiped out by these mysterious creatures. And all they know is that they have to be extremely quiet. They cannot make a sound, because otherwise these creatures will be able to hone in on them and pick them off incredibly easy. So the entire movie is them settling down at this farmhouse, trying to stay off the radar of these creatures, trying to figure out what their weaknesses might be, whatever they can do to survive. And one of their children, their daughter, is actually deaf. And this, this sort of adds an additional element to the movie, because one of the things that's so key about this film is the sound design.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a movie where the characters, two stars that people are very well aware of, don't get to do a lot of talking with their actual voices in the movie. There's a lot of sign language in this movie. There's a lot of subtitles. That's a very difficult thing to pull off for a mainstream audience. And I really kind of like this little trend we got going of, actors who have been known primarily for comedic presence in the past, like Jordan Peele, are now taking on these grandiose, kind of horror movies. And I got to tell you, man, I mean, I didn't think a whole lot of Krasinski's prior features, but this is an incredible step up behind the camera. This is a really incredible piece of work from him. I mean, not just from the sound design, but his work with the actors. Obviously, he's married to Emily Blunt, so
right.
there's clearly a rapport there. But he gets great work from the child actors. The movie's incredibly intense. There are wonderful suspense set pieces. It has incredible lows, incredible highs. It's a movie that, I was thinking about how it's being released by Paramount, and it's coming out on April 6th in theaters. And you think about some of the movies that Paramount has released.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
I mean, not just this, but Annihilation and Mother, and if you want to throw in stuff like Suburbicon and Downsizing, which may not have been as successful,
right?
You like Downsizing more than
I did.
Some of us did.
Yeah.
But films from filmmakers that might not be there for the box office dollar, but are clearly aiming for something higher. And I think Paramount gets behind this movie. Quiet Place could do quite well. I think that people will really like this movie because it's very intense. It's very it doesn't treat people as dummies. It has some humor in it. Krasinski and Blunt are very good, as are the kids in the movie. This is one that I hope people will support, because it's precisely the kind of movie that we want to see more of.
Yeah.
People taking chances like this.
Well, the trailer is very vague. It doesn't give a lot away.
Yeah, that's good.
And there's a lot in the trailer itself. There's a lot of silence, like in the in the trailer. And I was like, wow, if that's just going to be going to be the way the movie plays all the way through. I mean, I think it looks terrific, and I'm glad to hear that that's that good.
Oh yeah, you are going to absolutely love it.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I have no question about that.
Can't wait. Okay, that's A Quiet Place, which you can see in theaters on April 6th. All right, what do you want to go do next?
Well, we'll continue with Friday Night, which started better than it ended, because it ended with what was being heralded as an untitled Blumhouse project, though it was about the least, the worst kept secret, other than Ready Player One, basically this weekend.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a sequel to the movie Unfriended.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But, you and I were actually supporters of the first Unfriended movie, weren't we not?
Yes.
I thought you were, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But clearly, by your tone, you don't think we needed another one.
No, I don't think we needed another one.
Right. I think you got away with it and leave it at that and go on with your lives. But this one is actually now does have a title. It's called Unfriended Dark Web.
Ooh.
And, yeah. it follows the exact same premise of the first movie in that people are communicating through Windows and on their computer and video FaceTiming and all that kind of stuff. Except this time, and the only positive thing I can say about this movie is that this sequel doesn't take the supernatural element to it. Where the first one was kind of like a character from beyond the grave, manipulating what was going on.
Right.
This one is actually, it's really the dark web. And it's people that are, secret society type stuff that, a guy steals a laptop from the lost and found at his work or the computer cafe or wherever he works and logs in and then ends up, upsetting the wrong people, essentially, and it turns bad for him and his friends.
Mm.
And, I'm not normally the guy that harps upon things that get offensive in movies. I think that there can usually be a place for everything. But this movie rubbed me the wrong way more than a few times.
Mm.
Clearly not in any, creative way either, because the movie is incredibly dumb. Not that the first movie was anything special, but I thought that it was clever enough and it was well done enough that it turned into a pretty decent time, and the supernatural element actually kind of helped with that. With this being like actual people causing the mayhem, it amplifies the idiocy of it. The characters are far less sympathetic and dumber, and it gets to the point of just like, I'm kind of waiting for all of you to die. I don't care anymore. And by the end of it, I wasn't entirely displeased. But the movie itself is pretty much garbage.
Okay, that's Unfriended Dark Web, the sequel to Unfriended. I've noticed that Blumhouse is now putting their name on the titles. Because I saw the trailer for Truth or Dare.
Yes,
and
coming on April.
The title is Blumhouse's Truth or Dare.
Sure.
That's what it's... That's what. Yeah. So they're like a studio. Yeah. A studio is now putting their name on the movies.
Right. We made something for cheap, and we're going to make a lot of money.
Right. And every single trailer for the Blumhouse movies now starts with from the producers of Get Out.
Of course.
That's what.
Yeah. Of course. And it's just going to be the Oscar-winning Get Out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Okay, Eric, hang on.
Sure.
All right, Eric Childress is with us, and he's going to hang out with us. And then after 3, we'll get to the Monday morning movie reviews a little bit later. But we wanted to get Eric in here, exclusive reviews and talking about South by Southwest Film Festival. And more coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday morning, a little late start to the Monday morning movie reviews. We'll do it after the 3 o'clock news. Colin Suter and Jim Leskowski, who's filling in for Eric, are going to review the latest films. Right now, Eric Childress is with us. He is at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas, and had a big night last night, seeing the new Spielberg movie, going to the after party where Joan Jett and the Blackhearts were the house band, which is insane. And, and we're getting reviews of some of the other films that he's seen. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay, man, where do you want to go next?
Let's go to the big Saturday night premiere. Now, South by Southwest, over the years, we've talked about them. They've always seemed to have sort of a big universal premiere. I mean, this is a festival that premiered Bridesmaids, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, MacGruber, even Trainwreck. They've had a lot of sort of, you know, big Universal, you know, even Apatow related premieres over the years.
Yeah.
And this year it turned out to be Blockers.
Oh boy.
Yeah, but judging by your tone, you don't seem to be looking forward.
No, not okay. Not at all.
Okay. Well, for people who haven't seen the previews for this movie, John Cena, Leslie Mann, and Ike Barinholtz play parents who have been friends over the years, and now their daughters are going to their prom night. And the girls have basically taken the American Pie sex pact, and they've agreed that they're going to lose their virginity on prom night. And when their parents catch wind of this, they make it a point to do everything in their power to stop this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw the previews for the movie, Nick, I kind of shared your sentiment with it. I'm just like, oh, great. The last thing we really need is an updating of She's Out of Control with Tony Danza.
Right.
You know, we don't need that in our lives. And even as the, you know, a supporter of Apatow that I've been over the time, I think you mean just produced this movie, that I don't think that, you know, we need that. But that being said, the movie is better than you might actually think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised with it because, you know, if you watch the preview, there are some clearly, you know, over the top, slapsticky moments, particularly a moment with John Cena and his butt.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that some of that stuff doesn't work in the movie because it kind of doesn't entirely. But there are other moments in the movie that are not in the previews that actually do work quite well. There are some legitimately funny moments in this movie. Quite a few of them, a lot more than I even expected, actually. And it's, you know, the movies that Apatow, I mean, this movie was actually directed by a woman named Kay Cannon, who's done a lot of TV work over the years. She's been a writer for several years, Kay Cannon. And so she's, you know, actually trying to come with this material from a female perspective and actually trying to sort of get under the skin of the whole idea of the premise that we have kind of, when we've seen the trailer, kind of look like that looks really stupid, but actually trying to sort of get under the skin of that as to what exactly constitutes, you know, what is actually wrong with sex at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments in the movie that I think are kind of ultra woke in a way.
Uh-huh.
There's the moments that they get to a little speechifying sometimes, but there are other moments that are actually very heartfelt. I actually think the performance, Cena, Mann, and Barinholtz are actually quite good in the movie. I think Barinholtz is actually really good
mm-hmm.
in the movie. And there are things in the movie that don't work. There's some surprises that I'm not going to reveal to you, some cast members that actually get to some of the funnier bits in the movie. It's kind of a mixed bag. I wouldn't tell people not to see it because the funny moments are actually so funny that it kind of overshadows a lot of things that don't work in the movie. So I'm almost a marginal recommendation.
Okay.
On this one.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's just say it's better than you think it is.
Okay. All right. That's Blockers,
yeah.
Which comes out in theaters on April 6th. Okay. We got time for one more, Eric.
One more. Let's see. Okay. A movie called Shotgun.
Okay.
Which stars Makeham Munroe. And I'm blanking on his name at the moment, but he's an actor in the movie Shameless.
In the TV show Shameless?
The TV show Shameless.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he plays one of the sons in the show. And he plays a character who's kind of a, you know, young guy in his early 20s, you know, goes out to bars and drinking, living the lifestyle of women and all that kind of stuff, doesn't have a whole lot of direction in life, and he discovers that he has a very rare type of cancer. And he discovers this at the time that he actually meets this woman played by Makeham Munroe on the subway and actually comes into his sandwich shop. And they just form a relationship. They form a love affair, and this movie I think pulls off something that's very tricky to do in a lot of movies, which is actually to trace the course of an entire relationship in, you know, under 2 hours. and do so in a way that I think avoids a lot of the cliches and kind of the obvious beats that we expect in those types of up and down relationships. It actually plays like a very interesting companion piece to 50-50, which it really, you know, the first half of this movie is quite good. The sort of the up trajectory of the relationship is really nicely done. The two of them are really great together. The dialogue, the screenplay is really really is a nice formation on how these two characters relate to each other and how they sort of they form this bond, not just out of the necessity of the illness that he has, but the fact that they're two people that really just kind of need someone in each of their lives. The downslope is not quite as successful. It hits a little too many of those obvious beats that I was referring to. But overall, I thought this is a really solid film.
Nice.
I hope gets some distribution at one point because it's a movie that there are a lot of relationship films that we see at this festival. And but not as many as good as this one.
Yeah. And Meka Monroe, by the way, for people who don't know, she was in It Follows, and she rules.
Yes. And actually, one of her co-stars from It Follows plays one of her roommates.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I see Marissa Tomei's on the cast list. What does she play?
She plays the doctor.
Oh, okay.
She plays his doctor in the movie, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good that Marissa Tomei is working. I love her.
It's always nice to see her.
Always a pleasure. Yeah. Always. All right. Well, it sounds like you. Now, what else? What are you looking forward to, and how many more days are you going to be there?
I'm here for three more full days, and I'm looking forward to what do we got on the schedule here? Lee Winnell has a new directorial effort called Upgrade that I've heard good and not so good things about. Melanie Laurent has made another film called Galveston with Ben Foster and Elle Fanning that I'm looking forward to. And A Vigilante, which stars Olivia Wilde in a vigilante story that I hear is actually quite good. So I'm looking forward to all of those.
Okay, so there you go. And you'll give us a final tally and a report next week.
I certainly will.
Okay, man. Have a good time. Congratulations on having such a great night, man. That sounds like fantastic.
It was really a special evening, one I'm never going to forget.
Awesome. Okay, man. Have a good time. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
All right, buddy. There you go. Eric Childress having a fantastic time in Austin, Texas at the South by Southwest Film Festival, giving us reviews of movies that we'll be seeing in the coming weeks and months, as you know. All right, and speaking of movies, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jim Laskowski and Colin Suter will be with me to review the new movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower, where we do the show on Monday mornings from up here, and then we do the rest of it Tuesday through Friday downstairs in the Showcase Studio. And we're getting a little bit of a late start to the movie reviews because, as you just heard, Eric Childress is in Austin at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and we just heard from him, and we wanted to get him in here. But then Jim Laskowski is filling in for Eric, as he is in at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And Jim is the host of Voices and Visions podcast on the Now Playing Network. You can always check out nowplayingnetwork.net. And our good friend Colin Suter is joining us a little bit later than usual, but we're going to cover all the new movies. And I think we'll catch up on one from last week that we missed since I was off because of the Academy Awards. So there you go. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Also, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Follow us there. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Let's welcome the guys in. We'll talk about the new movies. And here is Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
And Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Nick. How's it going?
Good to
be back. And thank you so much for having me.
No, thanks for filling in. We appreciate it. And we just heard from Eric, who is in Austin at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And I appreciate you guys hanging out later than usual, but we will review all the new movies. Jim, you know, are you doing okay? Because I know you had a car accident the night of my screening of Lost in America, and you had to actually go to the ER. Are you all right?
Oh yeah. Thankfully, you know, I'm doing fine, and it wasn't anything major or serious, but you know, you do get a little shaken up, obviously, from something like that. But it didn't turn into changing lanes.
I know.
Thankfully.
No, but the person was texting. I understand.
Yes, yes.
Unbelievable.
And that's, of course, one of the worst things you could be doing.
Yeah.
Not supposed to be multitasking while behind the wheel.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're okay. That's, you know, that's the big thing. That's
Thank
the most
you.
Important
yeah,
thing.
Me too.
So, but I'm sorry that you missed our screening because it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's such a that's my favorite Albert Brooks movie, too,
yeah.
And I was dying to see it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Hopefully, there'll be another opportunity in the future.
It's just, it was just great. And it was, Colin, wasn't that a blast just seeing it on the big screen again?
It was. I mean, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it with an audience since it first came out.
Yeah.
You know, it's not exactly a movie that pops up a lot, you know, in retro screening. So to be able to see it in the theater is unique. And, you know, it's one of those movies I know every word,
Me
every
too.
Shot, everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seen it so many times. But it really was a different experience, again, watching it with a crowd.
It really was. It was great because, you know, my parents had not seen it, you know, probably since it came out. And my dad was rolling over. Like, he was just like, he was doubled over with laughter through the entire movie.
Yeah.
And when it was over, he's like, I forgot how funny that movie is. I'm like, yeah, it's one of the funniest movies ever made. So, I hope you guys can make it for next month April. I know, Colin, you're very excited about it. We are showing the director's cut of Little Shop of Horrors with the alternate ending. And I believe...
Yeah, I need to see that. I haven't seen that in a long time,
yeah.
So I'm excited, too.
Oh, it's a terrific movie, but that ending is just so great. I mean, I love the alternate ending. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it also will be introduced by Frank Oz. Like, there'll be an interview, and he introduces it and explains the ending and all that stuff, so...
Nice.
Yeah, so that's going to... Tuesday, April 3rd. Tuesday, April 3rd. Tickets are on sale right now. Reserve your seats now at amctheaters.com. Little Shop of Horrors with the alternative ending. It's only $9.99 to get in. We dropped the price. So there you go. All right. All right. Should we catch up real quick on Red Sparrow?
I got nothing to say
about it. No, I didn't get to see Red Sparrow.
Okay, good.
Wish from last week.
Okay. Then we have nothing to say about anything. From last week. so there you go.
Although one of my favorite films of last year, and I think one of Jim's favorites too, is Loveless, which is playing at the Music Box.
Oh yeah, all right, Colin, why don't you or Jim, you tell us about Loveless real quick, and then you guys can review that one.
Oh yeah, that's a heavy movie. So yeah, this is a movie, a foreign film that I believe was nominated actually.
It was nominated for
best foreign language film.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's from, I believe, a Russian director who previously gave us another interesting film called Leviathan, not to be confused with the
Peter Weller.
The one with Peter Weller, right? But it's a really interesting film. It's about this estranged Russian couple going through a very brutal divorce, and we were privy to that, to sort of the downfall of their relationship. And they also both have new partners and simply just want to start over until something monumentally tragic happens. Their 12-year-old son sort of just disappears out of nowhere after witnessing one of their fights. And from that point on, it's sort of this really interesting story about the search for the son, but also just the dynamics that these two people share and what it's like to experience this kind of loss, both, you know, with their relationship and with their child. And it's bleak, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of something like The Sweet Hereafter, in that there's a lot of humanity. You really empathize with everything that's taking place. But it's also just really hard to process at the same time, because you really start to feel for these characters, and especially, if you've gone through any sort of breakup, too, you sort of really, this is like the dark side of that experience as well. So, I mean, the title kind of lets you know what you're in for, but it's just beautifully directed. It's got some really interesting visual metaphors, I think, through, like, tying up the beginning and the very end. It has one of the more striking final shots, too. So I love this movie. It was in my top 10 of last year, but it's again, it's very bleak, but I can't recommend it enough.
Okay.
So people should check it out.
Yeah, it's out now. It's at the Music Box. It's actually at a couple of theaters. Let me get this here. It's at the Music Box. It's at the Landmark Renaissance in Highland Park. And it's at the Regal Lincolnshire in Lincolnshire, Illinois. So it is in three area theaters. Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with everything Jim said. And he used the word bleak, very much so, because this is a movie from Russia, and it really is about Russia. It is about the bleakness of Russia and living in that country. And one of the detectives that this couple has to deal with is very straightforward about, you know, what is most likely going to happen with their son missing. And he does not, you know, have much in the way of bedside manner in this case. He is just brutally honest about, hey, you're probably never going to get your kid back. So you better deal with that. You know, chances are, no. And if this were an American film, you'd put in Jake Gyllenhaal, and he would be the nicest person in the world, and it would be, you know, they would try to be soft about it. But this is not that film.
Okay.
But I do recommend it very much. It is beautifully directed, and I liked it more than his last film, which a lot of people were very high on, but I really wasn't. But this one is fantastic.
Okay. And that's Loveless. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Academy Awards. Wait, Colin, what did you think of the Oscars?
It was okay. You know, this is just one of those years where I'm just like, I kind of saw where this was going. Not a lot of surprises. I mean, maybe a few in the other minor categories. Well, the documentary was a surprise that they went with there. Mm-hmm. I did not think Icarus was going to win, although it's an excellent film. People should see it. But, yeah, it was just kind of fine. You know, Jimmy Kimmel was fine. I liked it last year more. It was more playful, more gags. You know, it was more of a low profile. He kept more of a low profile this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was fine.
All right, what about you, Jim?
Yeah, I pretty much echo all of that. I thought it was fine, too. I wasn't, like, blown away by the ceremony. I thought, you know, most of the awards went the way I expected. I was also surprised about Best Documentary Feature because I figured with Agnes Varda being at the age she's at and her accomplished career, she was definitely going to get it. But, no, there was a genuine surprise there, as well as Best Original Song was a surprise, which I was very happy about, of course.
Yeah, that was a pleasant surprise. I was happy about that.
Yeah. But overall, no, I mean, like, it was a pleasant show. I think, again, we say this every year, but it felt long and it went on too long. But other than that, I was relatively entertained throughout most of the ceremony and was pleasantly entertained.
It was way too long, but to me, it didn't feel long. I was entertained the whole time, but it was really long. And and I will say this: the most that I reacted to anything was Roger Deakins finally winning for cinematography. That was what I was like, finally. So,
yeah.
All right, guys, hang on.
Sure.
Hang on.
Right.
There's Colin Suter and Jim Leskowski, who's filling in for Eric Childress, who obviously is in Austin, Texas at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And we'll jump on to the new movies this week. And I've got box office to talk about as well. But we'll take a break right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and that means we get a little later start than usual, but that means we're reviewing the new movies. Eric Childress is at the South by Southwest Film Festival. So our buddy Jim Leskowski is filling in for him, and our good friend Colin Suter is here. So let's get back to it and get into the reviews. And Colin, welcome back.
Hello there.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello again.
All right, Colin, tell us about The Leisure Seeker.
All right. Well,
speaking of people getting in an RV.
Yes. actually watched this one the day before Lost in America.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. This is quite a week for that. So this stars Donald Sutherland and Helen Mirren as a married couple who take their old motor home called The Leisure Seeker out for a drive cross country. Presumably they avoided Nevada completely. Their son and daughter are agitated about it because Sutherland or Marin are in perfect health. In fact, Sutherland seems to be exhibiting the early stages of Alzheimer's. And Marin knows it, but she wants to have this experience with him anyway. So they watch old slideshows of family photos every night, and he does come back from his memory loss once in a while, you know, often at very inconvenient times. His memory loss and gain actually reveals infidelities he's had, and he seems focused and really remembers on a time back in their past when she might have been unfaithful to him, and he can't let it go. So they have to deal with that. So this is a movie that is kind of being advertised as this very light comedy, this light feel-good comedy. And there are light feel-good moments in the film, but, you know, like I did drop Alzheimer's in there, and that is, you know, really what this movie is about as far as, you know, what the purpose of this road trip is. When the movie is only focused on them, on the two of them, when it's just Sutherland and Mirren together, I think it works well enough. I think it's, I mean, it does kind of go through the checklist of road trip movie cliches that we've seen 100 times. But the two of them are so good that, you know, it doesn't really, it kind of transcends that. It's the characters on the periphery that I really found annoying, particularly the son, their son, who the actor plays in, is just really grating. A lot of the, you know, characters that come in and out of the road trip are, I don't know if they're just being misdirected or what, but it's just they're a little too either quirky or empty or just plain annoying. But when it's just these two, I think the movie works well enough. So it's and I think what the movie also makes an interesting choice about really being sort of nailing the film in a certain time and place. They're taking this tour in 2016, and the movie makes a lot of references to the election at that time. Mm-hmm. At one point, they wind up at a Trump rally, and
it takes place before the election. Then,
I mean, before the election,
yeah.
And the movie makes a point of that. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure what the purpose of that is, but it's it gives another at one point he loses memory and forgets that he voted Democrat all these years, and he starts joining in the Trump rally, and she has to remind him of that. I think that's the only reason why, because the movie doesn't really, you know, reference it otherwise. It's an interesting, you know, little time capsule, I guess, probably when they film the movie. So, and it's got moments. Sutherland and Mirren are really good together. They give really good performances, but you kind of know where it's going. It's kind of, you know, road trip cliches, and a lot of the supporting characters are pretty annoying. So I guess I'm not recommending it wholeheartedly, but I guess you could do worse. So.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it can't be worthless when you got those two leads. You know what I mean? and the fact that Donald Sutherland has never won an Oscar is absurd. Yeah. It's absolutely absurd.
And this is not going to happen with this movie either. I mean, they sent screeners of this out back during awards season, hoping, you know, it might catch fire, but it never really did. So, you know,
yeah,
I'm kind of dumping it now.
I love him so much. I just think he's so great and has been so great for so many years. And I think it's a crime that he's the only major performance in Ordinary People that didn't get nominated, and he gives the best performance in the movie. It's still one of my, every time I watch Ordinary People, I'm like, how in God's name did he not get nominated? That scene in the garage, you guys know what I'm talking about, where he talks about what color tie he was wearing to their son's funeral. Kills me every single time I see it. It's one of my favorite scenes ever. He's so good in that movie. So anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's he is one of these actors that we've been kind of taking for granted all these decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, when he goes, it's going to be like, oh, man,
we
did not honor him the way we should have.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Colin, Eric, and Jim, sorry. Jim, hang on. I get used to saying that. I get used to saying that every week, so you have to forgive me. Colin, hang on. Jim, hang on. We're going to take a break. We come back. We got the news coming up, and then after that, we're going to jump back into the new movie reviews here for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, where we do our Monday morning show from. We're down in the Showcase studio for Tuesday through Friday. And it's Nick DiGilio here, and we're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we have a Blackhawks Express from yesterday's game. That is coming up as well. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress is off in Austin, Texas at the South by Southwest Film Festival. So Jim Leskowski, who is with NowPlayingNetwork.net, fills in for him. And we'll continue with the movie reviews. And Colin is with us as well. Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Jim, tell us about The Strangers Prey at Night.
All righty. So about a decade ago, a movie starring Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler came out called The Strangers, and which in of itself was a remake of an even better home invasion horror film, French horror film called Them. And The Strangers was, you know, a decent minimalist buildup of dread that was, you know, pretty successful. It, you know, it was an experiment in terror that, you know, sort of gains much of its strength from what it didn't do or show. This time we have a different director with Johannes Roberts, I believe, and he did the equally simple kind of shark thriller from last year, 47 Meters Down, with Mandy Moore, and it was pretty solid. It had a couple of effective scares. Prey at Night follows a different unhappy family with Christina Hendricks as mom, Martin Henderson as dad, along with Bailey Madison and Lewis Pullman as the angst-ridden teens. They venture out to a trailer park to visit their aunt and uncle for a short stay that obviously goes awry. The family is slowly stalked by the same trio of theatrical psychopaths that we met over a decade ago. Two young women are in Halloween masks known as Dollface and Pinup Girl, and there's a man with a burlap sack over his head, kind of looking like a crude scarecrow. And that's really all about all you can expect for a slasher movie in terms of plot. We side with one team while another group of villains chase them, essentially. And there's a lot of low-lying fog before the mass killers sort of come out, and there's also a vehicle fire. And I don't know if about you guys, but I certainly noticed a distinct John Carpenter influence with those two inclusions there. And this definitely lacks the subtlety and nuance of early John Carpenter, but there's some things to enjoy here, I thought. There's a couple of cute sort of 80s music cues that made me smile a little bit, and there are a few kind of effective sequences in this one, particularly one that takes place in a pool. So I think this director does a decent job kind of ratcheting up the terror and suspense, much like he did with his previous film. But at the same time, it really kind of doesn't offer up anything new or gives his cast much to do other than run or react or scream. And if you've seen the first Strangers, you probably already know what you're in for here. I will say that this one kind of has a ludicrously sort of drawn out finale that made me wince a bit. And, you know, in comparison to a lot of other home invasion thrillers, it just can't hold a candle to the French horror film Them or the minimalist other horror home invasion film Hush from director Mike Flanagan. But at the same time, I walked into this with very low expectations, came out reasonably surprised, you know, because I just simply find this premise to really get under my skin. Obviously, the idea of being chased, pursued, or terrorized is a familiar trope in horror, but it usually works on me, especially when the influence is mainly John Carpenter here, with some other nods to horror films of the past. But at the same time, I can't, like, I'm not gung-ho about it. I'm not 100% recommending it either. But if you're a diehard horror fan, you could do a lot worse, especially if you see this with a crowd that's game and reactive. But mostly I'm in the middle with The Strangers sequel here.
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. The original, I can't believe, were people waiting 10 years for a sequel to The Strangers? I wasn't aware of that. I think the original one from 2008 is a better film. And I think yes. Much creepier. This one is, you said, less subtle, much less subtle. I mean, this kind of goes for the jugular a lot more than the original did. And you know, and again, you know, you mentioned them. Them is like the granddaddy of these movies. And for people who are regular listeners, know that I have a phobia, a home invasion phobia that freaks me out. And whenever I see a movie that involves home invasion, I'm an easy target when it comes to that. So there was stuff in this movie that did freak me out, and that's just because personally it freaks me out. You know,
yeah.
The whole idea freaks me out. I keep going back, and this is not a badly made movie. There are some pretty effective sequences, and yeah, there's obviously little homages to other horror films and directors and things like that, and I thought that was kind of fun. I just keep thinking every time I see some of these new movies that are coming, I just how many more, you know, because this it's like The Purge, because like these Purge movies that come out are very similar now in style to what this is. This is more like a Purge film than like a home invasion movie.
Yeah, or something like Your Next.
Yeah, kinda. Yeah. Well, Next. Your Next is a phenomenal movie, though. But You know, this one is not in the same level as that. You know, the characters are barely defined. You know, you got your teenagers, you got your mom, you got your dad, and you know, the whole why they're doing this, why these strangers are doing this is, you know, it's supposed to be chilling because like they just do it because they want to do it. But, I mean, there are, like I said, there are set pieces in here that are pretty good. It's not a terrible movie. There are a few moments that are kind of scary. The audience I saw it with had a good time. They seem to be screaming in the right place and having some fun. So it worked on the crowd that I saw it with. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's horrible. It just kind of, it's there. But for people who want to be scared and want to see a really terrifying home invasion movie, as Jim has mentioned a couple of times, the original French movie, Them, don't get it confused with the giant ant movie from the 50s. The French title is Eels, ILS. It's called Them, and it is an absolutely terrifying movie. Like, had me in the fetal position when I was watching it. I had to be comforted by my ex-wife while we were watching the movie. And it still holds up, and it's great, too, because it's a very, very simple premise, and it's 79 minutes long. So it's just streamlined, it's scary, it's awesome, and then it's over. And this is a short movie, too. It's under an hour and a half, so
yeah.
So anyway, you could do worse. It's not terrible. You know, if you're a horror fanatic and you want to see something kind of creepy, yeah, check it out. It's not great, but you know, it's not horrible. So that's as wishy-washy reviews as we can possibly give the movie, Jim. So
yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
All right. Didn't get a chance to see this one, Colin, and I'm really, really interested in it. Tell us about Gringo.
All right. Well, this stars David Oyelowo as Harold, as this mild-mannered businessman for a pharmaceutical company, and whose bosses, played by Joel Edgerton and Charlize Theron, are scheming a deal with a plant owner in Mexico. And Harold knows that his bosses are up to no good, but the three of them travel to Mexico to put some heat under one of the plant owners to stop dealing with the cartels. And that's one part of the plot. The main story, yeah, deals with Harold, who, you know, in addition to all this, finds out that his wife is cheating on him, and his boss, who's a friend of his, who he's known since college, is scheming against him in many ways as well. So he decides to take matters into his own hands by faking a kidnapping in Mexico, just as Edgerton and Theron have left and sort of left him behind because they thought he was just running late and didn't want to deal with him anymore. They don't think very much of him. They don't respect him very much. They just kind of have him along for, you know, just reasons that, you know, he's just necessary, but they don't really like him. But Harold's plot and his kidnapping plot that he sort of cooks up himself against Edgerton and Theron, it works up to a point because we are dealing with Mexican drug cartels. So obviously his plan doesn't quite go as he wants it to. But then there's this other story, and then you got Amanda Seyfried and Harry Treadaway, who play a young couple who also have a deal going on with the cartels. And who get caught up in Harold's plot as well. And then you got Charles O'Copley as Edgerton's brother, who gets involved also, and Sandy Newton plays David Oyelowo's wife. So there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of setup, a lot of exposition, and it can be very cumbersome in that first half hour. once the kidnapping plot kicks in, like it the movie sort of relaxes a little bit more, and the pace is very much an action comedy. Maybe a little more emphasis on the action. I can't say I laughed that much, but here's the thing. This is a movie, I mean, we've kind of seen this sort of thing before, but the casting of David Oyelowo in the lead here is what makes this an interesting film by itself. They could have put anybody in this role, but they went with, a guy who has Nigerian background, which makes him this sort of fish out of water aspect of him being in Mexico all the more interesting and sort of changes the dynamic a little bit. And I think that's a really smart and interesting choice. And he's terrific at this. And it's a comedic performance as well as a dramatic.
But he's not known for comedic performances.
Exactly. And that also just makes the movie eminently watchable. And you know, what would otherwise be a just kind of forgettable action comedy starring, a typical, like, I don't know, Zach Galifianakis type or somebody like that. It would just feel like you forget about it. But they made an interesting choice here with the lead, and it sort of changes the dynamic, changes the energy of it a little bit. And for that, I'm recommending the movie. And the movie is directed by Nash Edgerton, who made a terrific movie called The Square many years ago, not to be confused with the foreign Academy Award nominee, and a couple of great 10-minute short films, which are both on YouTube. One's called Spider, one's called Bear. I can't recommend those highly enough. So if you get a chance, go on YouTube, look those up.
And he's Joel Edgerton's brother.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this guy really knows how to put together, an action sequence, a comedy sequence, really knows how to make you jump out of your seat. So, I mean, this is a story. It's filled with characters we've seen before. It's got story elements we've seen many times before. So it's not a great script necessarily, but it's got a really interesting, lead at the center of it. And, it's got the right amount of, it's got a right energy to it that I found appealing. So I'm recommending this film.
Okay, cool. I'm really interested in seeing it, because I think the cast is pretty terrific. And, I thought the trailer was really great. And so that's Gringo, which is playing everywhere right now. And Colin is recommending it. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
Okay, we'll do.
All right. We've got more movies to talk about, and we're talking about the new movies. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, a little bit later than usual start, because we were talking with Eric, who is at the South by Southwest Film Festival. And we're going to come back after we got weather. We got traffic right here. I got the weather for you right now. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower right now. We're in the middle of the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Every week on Monday, Colin Suter and Eric Childress join me to review all the new movies, and we talk box office as well. Eric is at the South by Southwest Film Festival, so our buddy Jim Leskowski is filling in, and Colin Suter is here, and let's get back to the movies. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right, Jim, you guys both saw this one. I didn't, and I kind of couldn't bring myself to do it, but... Jim, tell us about A Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, boy. All right. A Wrinkle in Time adapts the beloved classic book with a lot of expectations and eagerness from the many, many fans of the source material. Acclaimed director Ava DuVernay takes on the task, casting names both big and small here in the process. Newcomer Storm Reid plays Meg, who is kind of a solemn preteen mourning the disappearance of her idealistic astrophysicist father, played by Chris Pine, as well as coping with the cruelty of some school bullies. Her despair is obviously apparent, but counterbalanced a little bit with the wild-eyed naivete of her younger brother, Charles Wallace. And he happens to summon three otherworldly mystic women. There's a rather manic Reese Witherspoon as Mrs. What's It, Mindy Kaling as the, quote, happy Mrs. Who, and Oprah Winfrey, of course, as the all-knowing Mrs. Witch. So her with her brother and a newfound friend as well, kind of in tow, they travel across many universes under the guidance of the Mrs. to rescue her lost father from the evil forces of the invading It, which has trapped him. And so, yes, it's up to the young crew to do what they can to overcome their own demons, as well as the darkness that takes hold of not only Dad, but even Meg's young brother at one point. Will they succeed and return home safely and wiser, stronger, and more in touch with their positive energy? Well, this is certainly an adaptation of a novel for the younger demographic, and one would hope that adults would have a joyful time, too. So, you know, strangely enough, Nick, you've had this a segment on the show in the past where you talk about movies or books you haven't seen or read before that would shock people.
Yeah.
Well, somehow A Wrinkle in Time is a novel that just never crossed my path in the
past. Me neither. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people adore this book. You know, I so many friends on Facebook were just talking about, oh man, I love the book. It was one of my favorites as a kid. I can't wait to see the movie. Well, I hated to tell them that I would stick with the book even though I haven't read it. I thought maybe this would be up my alley since I love time travel and multiverses and an old fashioned good versus evil kind of story. But the setup of the characters here certainly felt rushed to me. And once we're kind of introduced to all the misses, I more or less began to tune out as things went along. I mean, DuVernay's visual influences kind of skew a little closer to something like Miyazaki and 80s Jim Henson, but I found its weirdness more off-putting than engaging for me. At the same time, it's very sincere and kind of hokey in terms of its message that it's trying to convey about simply just being an individual capable of great things and learning how to balance the positive and the negative, I guess. So, I mean, I like that overall sentiment for the younger demographic, like I mentioned, but I just don't think adults are really going to get a whole lot out of this film. I mean, there's so many other great movies out there that kids and adults can enjoy and rent, like, Coco or Peach Dragon. And Wrinkle in Time just cannot have that same kind of awe and emotional impact that is, inspiring in any kind of way. I felt the performances here were pretty flat, and like I mentioned, the visuals did very little for me. I really want to champion DuVernay simply due to her other films in the past, but I just think that maybe ambition and good intentions got the best of her in the end. I think someone like Terry Gilliam or back in the days of or the early days of Tim Burton, they could have done something with this material that's a little bit more inventive and creepy. But I think this adaptation is just a real letdown, and overall, I cannot recommend it.
Okay, Colin, what about you?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same boat with this one. This is a movie I really wanted to like. I've never read the book either, by the way. And, because this is a movie that really has the courage of its convictions, to be a movie that is so heartfelt and feel good and sincere at a time when it's really hard to get in that mindset for a lot of people. But this is a movie that really believes in what it's selling to its audience. And you can feel that. You can feel everybody who made this movie is really on board with it and is really, going to go for broke in terms of the sentiment that it has. But there's just no escaping the hollow feeling you have when watching it. It just kind of, goes through another, here we go again, in a movie that goes through the motions of what it is. In this case, like a quest film, a fantasy, where they just encounter all these different characters, Zach Galifianakis, Michael Peña, David Oyelowo is in it too. Just sort of slowly getting closer to their destination. And then when, you get to that final emotional moment, it just doesn't land. None of it really does, because there's something in the script that is just missing, that is crucial to get, the audience on board in a real way. And it doesn't help either that the second half of the movie is mostly about the little kid the little brother who has this like transformation sort of against his will. And it's an annoying performance. It really is. And it just, I could not get past it. Is, you know, just one of these overly precocious, overcoached Hollywood kid actors, you know, just really just sort of grating on my nerves. You know, Jim mentioned Pete's Dragon. We're talking about the remake of Pete's Dragon, by the way.
Right.
Remake. That's what we're talking about. And that's a perfect example of the kind of movie that this could have been. And it's kind of, it is surprising that it's coming from a director whose work really has been standing out. This is, you know, she sort of reinvented the biopic in a way with Selma, and you know, did a really terrific documentary last year called 13th. You know, this is a director who has a real distinct voice and a real distinct vision, but I'm just not seeing it here. So yeah, this is a really sort of hollow, earnest, but almost to a fault movie that I can't really recommend either.
Yeah. All right, guys, hang on, okay? We're going to take a break here for the news, and then when we come back, we got one more movie to review, and it's a good one. So we'll talk about that right after the news here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive right here on WGN. Every weekday morning, I'm here from 2 to 5 a.m. And every Monday morning, we review all the new movies, which is what we're doing right now. Eric is off this morning because he's at the South by Southwest Film Festival, so Jim Laskowski is filling in. And Colin Suter is joining us to talk about the new movies and review the new movies. I will also cover box office in a little bit as well. My dad will be calling in to tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And we got a Blackhawks Express to play back as well. So let's get back to it. We got one more movie to review. Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Colin. Tell everybody about Thoroughbreds.
All right. Well, this is a dark little drama, comedy, I don't know what you want to call it, but
yeah.
Let's just say it's dark. A little ditty about two teenage girls who hail from a privileged upper-class neighborhood. Olivia Cooke plays Amanda, this very peculiar and emotionally distant girl who is getting tutored by one of her peers named Lily, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And they somehow grow a friendship, even though Amanda says she really has no feelings of any kind. Then Amanda meets Lily's stepfather, Mark, played by Paul Sparks, who we gather probably abuses Lily in some way. It's a little vague, but Amanda picks up on the vibe that's in the room every time he enters. And they start to talk about what would happen if maybe he could be gotten rid of. That's probably all I should say from here on in, except that this is one of the final screen performances of the late Anton Yelchin, who plays an older guy in their neighborhood who is just kind of drifting on the fringes of society. He's been in prison. He's in his 20s, but for some reason he's hanging out at teenage parties, selling weed probably. But he might be able to help them out. So this is very much a movie about this sort of upperclassmanship of young people who grow up in this sort of privileged world where everything pretty much comes easy. And so everything seems easy and feels easy, except when it comes, in this case, when it comes to matters of the heart and emotions and what it means to be a friend and all that. This is a movie that I really had more of an admiration for on a filmmaking level and an acting level. This is directed by a guy named Corey Finley. It's his first film, and it very much calls attention to a director who, you know, has a lot of great promise ahead of him. It did remind me a lot of Krisha, a movie by Trey Edward Schultz, and his first film, which I thought was a little more audacious, but definitely has the same sort of framing device, sound design, you know, music score. It's a very unsettling kind of, you know, a lot of textures in it. And the performances here by the two leads, I think, really make this movie also stand out. It's a movie that has a tone that kind of, you know, gets a little old for me after a while, this sort of deadpan tone that I think is typical of movies like this. I mean, this is, I realize I'm not going to be as high on this as maybe you are, but I think it just kind of, it sort of wears thin for me after a while, the tone of the movie. I sort of needed another color after a while, or another something. But I think on a technical level and on a performance level, this is a movie definitely worth seeing. I think the story is kind of, we've seen it before, but I think there's enough there's enough rich details going on with the characters and the actors who bring them out, and Corey Finley's direction. I think there's a movie that is definitely worth seeing.
Okay. Jim, go ahead.
I, on the other hand, I'm with you on this one, Nick. I absolutely loved this movie. I didn't get a chance to see the new Michael Haneke movie, but I almost thought of it as like, well, you know, this is kind of in that same vein, more or less. I mean, it's definitely got, I hadn't thought of the Acrisha comparison, but yeah, that's also kind of apt here as well. It's just, a lot of that has to do, I think, with the ratcheting up of tension, mostly with just behavior, with people's reactions to certain things. And the sound design is amazing in this. I mean, there's a sequence late on that I wouldn't dream of giving away that is really all about sound, and it really, really, really got to me. As did the whole movie. I mean, a lot of it has to do with these performances and just the dialogue here. The movie is almost entirely set practically within one house. It could have been a play, and at times it reminded me of like just the right kind of updating of something like Heather's, because you get the idea early on that it's kind of a takedown of the clueless bourgeois elite. You know, the mom is detached and stepdad can't sculpt, you know, he can't stop sculpting his abs with the rowing machine upstairs. And it's just really dark dramedy that really kind of got to me, got under my skin. It definitely plays in like kind of like the Hitchcock wheelhouse at times, with a little bit of May thrown in there, in my opinion. But yeah, it's this absolutely striking debut and a very memorable and sadly final turn from the late Anton Yelchin, like Colin mentioned. But I was kind of floored by this one. I know it's early, but this is definitely my favorite film of 2018 so far. But I gotta tell people, prepare yourself for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's only March, but this is the best thing I've seen all year. I think it's one of the best debuts in years. A great script, great direction, very distinctive style, very distinctive tone. The performances are phenomenal in this movie. Olivia Cooke, who I'm not really familiar with. Have you guys seen her in anything else?
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Oh, right.
To mind. I think that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But she's unbelievable, and Anya Taylor-Joy continues to be, a really interesting screen presence who makes really cool choices, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And Anton Yelchin. I can't, I was watching the movie, and it's just such a tragedy what happened to him. I mean, it's obviously a tragedy, you know, that he died so young and in such a stupid accident. But just watching him in this movie, he was so good. He was such a natural, good actor who made strong choices and who was really powerful on screen. And I think brought a real sense of humor, to the role. The stuff between the two girls, between Amanda and Lily, it's really interesting how it develops, how the characters change over the course of the running time of the movie. And, I was really moved by this film. I know that, you know, like, I guess it's got this cold sort of feel to it, but there's the final monologue in this movie that it recounts a dream And the final, one of the final images in the movie made me cry. I just started weeping. I couldn't believe how emotional I got over it. And it was a movie that I think builds on that. And this is not a movie about shock. They're advertising it, like, one of the quotes is, it's Heathers meets American Psycho. And it's
no.
It's not that at all. It's not even remotely like that. There are things that are said about privilege. There are things that are said about friendship, mostly friendship. There's also just like being disconnected emotionally. Like Olivia Cooke's character is so fascinating, and what she does at the beginning of the film, what happens, you know, what is the framing is fascinating and terrifying. And when it's recalled finally, when she recalls the whole thing, it's devastating. And Anya Taylor-Joy's character, Lily, completely transforms. And all of these things happen slowly. Like, the relationship between these two girls is fascinating. It starts out really cold, like they've known each other a really long time. And they haven't seen each other in a while. And, you know, Olivia Cooke's character passes judgment immediately. And Anya Taylor-Joy's character is one way and then suddenly starts to change. And by the end of the movie, she's a completely different character than she was at the beginning. I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie. My parents, however, did not. And the audience of five in the theater, I don't think they kind of liked it either. It's a very distinctive film. It's a strange one. It's kind of I think it's very challenging. But ultimately, to me, it pays off in spades. It's my favorite film of the year so far. I absolutely love this movie. Now, it is dark, it is challenging, and it's not a happy movie. They're advertising it as like a comedy. There are things in it that made me laugh. There are a few moments in it that made me laugh. And Anton Yelchin has some pretty good laughs in it as well. But this is a pretty serious film about psychology and about being a teenager and being rich and being disconnected and just being cold. And it is a wonderful movie that has an emotional payoff that is huge for me. Just absolutely huge. I love Thoroughbreds. I love it. So, all right.
Amen. All right.
What do we got next week, Colin? Do we know?
We got Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Alicia Vikander.
Mm-hmm.
We got Love, Simon. Teenage drama.
Right.
And we got The Death of Stalin.
Oh, yes.
The new one from Iannucci.
Right.
So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
Jim, buddy, thank you so much for filling in for us. We appreciate it.
Oh, happy to anytime. It's always
a
blast.
Take care.
Again.
Colin, I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
There you go. Colin Suter and Jim Leskowski reviewing the new movies with me. We're going to take a break here. We got weather, we got traffic, and after that, I will run down the box office for you right here on 720 WGN, and let's get your weather right now. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're going to talk about daylight saving, which happened over the weekend. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we've got a Blackhawks Express coming up. We just finished all the movie reviews, and I really flipped over Thoroughbreds. I kind of lost my mind. Dan, so parents not so much. I went to go see the Strangers Pray in the Night or whatever. I went to see that one on my own, and then my folks and I went to go see Thoroughbreds, and they just were, my dad especially was like, I don't know, what the hell was that? I think it's the best movie of the year, and I think my dad thinks I'm nuts.
I don't think he thinks.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, it didn't even make. I have the top 12 movies, and Thoroughbreds. I don't even have the numbers for how much Thoroughbreds made, and there was nobody in the theater. It's not in as many theaters as a lot of the other. You know, I mean, it's not like Wrinkle of Time is in, like, you know, in Chicago. It's in 50 area theaters, and I think like Thoroughbreds is in like 15 or 16 theaters, so it's not in a ton. But man, anyway, well, I got the box office here. Number one, I mean, this is just incredible. Black Panther, $41 million this weekend. In America alone, it's $562 million it's made. $562 million. You haven't seen it yet, have you?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Do you know anybody who hasn't seen it? I mean, it seems to me like everyone.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, it's definitely one of those.
Jen, have you seen Black Panther?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I am a comic book girl, so I see all those movies as soon as they come out.
I thought it was great.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And man, is it making money. I mean, it's just really tearing it up at the box office. So that continues to be, and my guess is it'll still be number one next week. That would be my guess, considering what we were just talking about, you know, the movies that are coming out. Unless, I don't know, maybe Tomb Raider? I don't think so.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that does, considering the nostalgia factor, you know, because that game was huge when I was younger.
Do you think that the Angelina Jolie movies are going to affect the box office for this one at all?
I honestly think they're so forgettable that it might not, you know?
No, they're bad movies. Yeah. Both of them are bad. I just don't know whether... I mean, I'm assuming that there aren't real loyalists to the Angelina... No, Angelina Jolie will always be Tomb Raider. I don't think there's going to be a large contingency of people who are upset that it's not Angelina Jolie and they're going into a different direction.
Right. And, I mean, the casting of Alicia Vikander was interesting because, obviously, she was known as an actress, not as an action star.
Yeah. Got herself an Oscar and everything.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how she does, but does she have a big enough following where it'll, you know, push through?
Hey, I'm going to, you know why I'm going to see it?
Why is that?
McNulty from The Wire is
it. Ah, there you go.
McNulty from The Wire plays her dad. So right there, I'm like, oh, McNulty. Hey, I'm watching that Unsolved Biggie Tupac thing, which I am enjoying. I like it more than Feinberg does. And Bunk just showed up from The Wire.
Oh, there you go.
And I was just like, it's Bunk! It's ridiculous how I still never call the actors by their real names. And I it's the only show that I ever that I ever do that. You know what I mean? Everybody is the character that they played. It's ridiculous. By the way, Omar was on Colbert last week. Michael K. Williams is his actual name. And I did, you know, I had an encounter with with him on the street some years ago. And I'm walking down the street and there he is. And, you know, you can't mistake Omar. I mean, that's Michael K. Williams, a very distinctive looking dude. And you can't, you know, it's not, that guy looks like Omar. That's Omar. And this was back when I was a drinking man. And I'd had a few cocktails and I was walking down the street and I go, effing Omar! And I point at him and he starts laughing and I shake his hand and I tell him how great he is and all that stuff. And then we walk away and luckily he was laughing. Otherwise he could have punched me right in the mouth. He was with another dude and I just didn't. So I just said, effing Omar. I'm sure he gets that a lot.
I would imagine.
So, and when he was on Colbert pulled out this picture of a meme that's been going around on the internet. As did you ever watch The Wire?
No, I didn't.
All right, you know of the character right?
Yeah.
The neighbors would go nuts when Omar would just walk down. He was an enforcer. He's like a Robin Hood kind of guy. He stole from drug dealers, you know. And he was a real complex character, like just incredible. And so there was a lot of scenes of him like walking down the street. He's got a long trench coat on, Omar, do-rag, shotgun. He just walked down the street with a shotgun. And there were many scenes of that. And then, like, you could hear the people in the neighborhood going, Omar coming! Omar coming! And so there's a meme now that's going around where they... And he showed it to Michael K. Williams, and Williams lost it. He laughed his ass off. They put Robert Mueller's face over Omar's face, and it's just Robert Mueller walking down the street with a shotgun. It says, Mueller's coming! Michael K. Williams lost it. So anyway, all right. Your number one movie of the week is Black Panther. Wrinkle in Time came in second with $33 million. Did very well, but the story of the box office is Black Panther. That's it, and it's going to be again next week. Okay, we got a break. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about daylight saving time. All right here on 720 WGN.